First case for argument, Narducci versus Moore. Mr. DeConcini? Mr. DeCiani, I'm sorry.
Yeah, yes.
DeCiani.
Thank you.
Two tries to, for sure, I'll get it.
Well, you've elevated me to a former senator of Arizona, which
that's
I'm
true.
Flattered to.
Yeah, had a long career.
Yes. May it please the court, as we discussed, my name is Thomas DeCiani, and I represent the defendants in this case, Donald Lem and Gregory Moore. This is an appeal, an interlocutory appeal, from a denial of qualified immunity in the district court. The defendant, Lem, was the former mayor of the village of Bellwood, Illinois, and defendant Moore was the former police chief of the village of Bellwood. The case arises out of the routine taping of five telephone lines in the finance department in the village of Bellwood. This taping took place over a period of about 6 years, it was hooked up by the police department into the police taping system. And it's undisputed that the reasons for the taping was that there had been a series of threats from angry customers, as there might as might happen over time, involving water bills and poor public service. There had been complaints about some rude behavior by public employees, the finance department employees, and there had been some complaints from supervisors about an excessive or abundant number of personal calls.
Yeah, the record's a little unclear on whether employees knew that the calls were being recorded. Can you shed some light on that?
I can. The employees did know that the calls were being recorded. They were told, and several of those employees gave depositions about their knowledge of it. Now, Mr. Narducci denies that he himself knew, although that's disputed as well. There's evidence in the record. Gary Modro, a police department employee who was in charge of the taping system, he testified at his deposition that when Mr. Narducci started with the village, Mr. Modro, in showing him around, told him that these finance department lines are taped. Mr. Narducci denies that, and of course, since that's a disputed fact, it's not something that we've relied on in making any of our arguments in the case.
Were any materials given to a new employee indicating that?
There's no evidence of that. There's no evidence of any written warning or notice or anything that would have been posted to provide notice. The only testimony is that the employees knew of it. Mr. Narducci says he did not know of it.
And then this whole beep. Oh,
go
sorry.
Ahead.
This whole beep thing, this sound, this alleged sound that was supposed to be on, that seems to be disputed too.
It is disputed. It is disputed. There was testimony from employees who said that there was a beep tone on that line. Some of them even had complained that it was too loud and it was interfering with some of their communications. Mr. Narducci says he never heard a beep tone on the lines. By the time this case came to fruition, where it actually became litigated, the system had been changed. The tapes had been discarded or otherwise were unplayable. So there was no way to go back and have any documentary evidence of whether there were beep tones or not. And the system had been dismantled. There is disputed evidence about whether there were beep tones. Again, it's not something we've relied on because of that dispute, although it does become relevant when, as we say, Judge Shader, in deciding the qualified immunity issue, denying summary judgment, we believe didn't just deny it, but actually went to the point where he made a finding that this was an unreasonable taping. As the record shows, the next discussion after that ruling was what proof of damages would the plaintiff put forth. So we treat this decision not just as a denial of qualified immunity to the defendants, but in essence a grant of summary judgment to the plaintiffs, at least on that unlawful taping issue.
But wouldn't the plaintiff be entitled to at least nominal damage for the Fourth Amendment violation, even if there's no actual harm?
Well, that's arguable. The Carey versus Pifus case talks about nominal damages in due process cases. I'm not aware of a case that said that you are automatically entitled to nominal damages if there is a Fourth Amendment violation. I think Carey holds that that's true for due process, but certainly there's good arguments on both sides. Our position is that the next step in this case, at a minimum, should not have been addressing the question of damages, at a minimum, it should have been the judge saying that there's factual issues that have to be resolved before I can find that this was an unreasonable taping for a number of reasons. First, on the question of whether or not the plaintiff had a reasonable expectation of privacy, and secondly, on whether it was reasonable or not. I see those as, at a minimum, fact issues. Now, again, we argued that the undisputed facts established qualified immunity for the defendants on those issues and on the question of whether it was a violation of the Fourth Amendment. Judge Shader didn't see it that way. We understand that. But he discounted the need for the plaintiff to establish a reasonable expectation of privacy, which made the questions of whether or not, which made those two disputes irrelevant. Whether or not there was a beep tone and whether or not the plaintiff was ever told about the taping would go to the question of whether or not he had a reasonable expectation of privacy. The district judge said, based on O'Connor and based on two Seventh Circuit cases that have applied O'Connor, a reasonable expectation of privacy is not an element, is not a necessary threshold of a Fourth Amendment protection when you're dealing with a workplace situation. Now we think that's wrong, and we think that's wrong for a number of reasons. First of all, the district court had to have been relying on Judge Scalia's concurring opinion in O'Connor. The four plurality justices said talked about a reasonable expectation of privacy. Justice Scalia in his concurring opinion said, as a general matter, there's a Fourth Amendment protection here. And then, of course, the four dissenters thought that it was that the entire full-blown Fourth Amendment probable cause warrant requirements applied in that situation. So in that situation, you have eight justices who believe that there's a reasonable expectation of privacy is an element in the workplace search situation. But it appears that the district court went strictly to Judge Scalia's concurring opinion and relied on that observation by Judge Scalia to conclude that there's no need to even address the question of reasonable expectation of privacy when we're dealing with a workplace situation. We think that's wrong because, first of all, analyzing O'Connor, we think it's wrong for the reasons I just stated, but also that would give an employee, a government employee, a greater Fourth Amendment protection in the workplace than an ordinary citizen would have on the street. Because an ordinary citizen on the street always has to establish before he or she can argue that there has been a Fourth Amendment violation, his Fourth Amendment rights have been violated, that he or she had a reasonable expectation of privacy, which was unreasonably abridged by some governmental action. Under Judge Shader's decision, a workplace employee, a government workplace employee, wouldn't have to even establish that. The government employee would only have to establish that something that his employer did was unreasonable in connection with some practice, some action, something that affected that employee's property, conversations, recordings, whatever, was unreasonable, skipping the reasonable expectation of privacy element. We think that's wrong. It was our position in the district court that the undisputed facts established that Mr. Narducci did not have a reasonable expectation of privacy. These were calls that came into the finance department. They were calls that had to be taken on phones that are located in the department. The calls, the discussions would take place out in the open amongst customers or other employees or supervisors or people who were there. These phones weren't there for private conversation purposes. They were there for government business. The recordings that were made weren't listened to. They were put on a shelf. It's undisputed that there was no instance where the recordings were ever listened to. They would be put on a shelf for 30 days in case they were ever needed, and then they'd be erased and recycled, and the tapes would be reused, part of the regular police system.
This is really going to the other issue of reasonableness, but why didn't the recording stop when the employee stopped receiving threats?
Well, that's an issue that the court found a factor in finding it unreasonable.
Right.
It became a part of the system. None of the What distinguishes this type of taping from CATS and other types of tapings that the cases have dealt with, this was not a targeted investigation. They weren't after somebody. It was not triggered by some evidence of wrongdoing or crime in particular. It was a management tactic. It was something that they thought would improve the operation of the department.
Was there anything in the record that indicated that this policy was reviewed after the employee stopped receiving threats?
Well, it was only reviewed in the sense that the police department had to keep doing it.
Right. No, I mean the policy.
No,
like
there isn't.
Like the memos that flew right. by counsel.
Like the evaluation
right.
that went on when it first went in.
Exactly.
No, there's no evidence that that occurred. But again, this was monitored by an independent board that was funded by a special tax for a 911 system. That's who implemented it and monitored it, and the police department operated it. So it's not like it just sort of operated and nobody paid any attention to it. There were people who were...
Well, they were maintaining the system.
That's correct.
Nobody looked at the policy consideration.
That's correct. I think the simple answer to your question, Your Honor, is that it became a part of the system that nobody found reason to reevaluate. But I disagree that that's unreasonable.
Wasn't that unreasonable when it was 6 years? And
well,
no policy review.
Yeah, but those issues that led to the taping to begin with are not the types of issues that go away when you're running a government office. There will be continued, there's the potential for continued threats. There's the potential for continued complaints about rude behavior by village employees. There's the potential for excessive personal calls. So I think it's wrong to look at this as something that was done solely for the purpose of addressing these issues that arose. It was done for a purpose that was considered to be part of the efficient management of the department. And the fact that they weren't monitored, they weren't used to try to catch people, to invade anything that somebody might consider to be private, I think just goes to the question. It leads to the reasonable, or lends to the conclusion that this was reasonable. It was a routine practice in the department, not targeted at any particular individual or investigation. The question that we think is very clear is that the district court found the right that the plaintiff alleged here clearly established. And we disagree with that, obviously. The two cases that the district court relied on were the Gossmeyer case and the Burge case, both of which dealt with entirely different situations, and both of which, it bears saying, found that the government searches in those cases, the workplace searches, were appropriate and reasonable. Both of them dealt with secluded areas like briefcases, file cabinets, desk drawers, storage units, offices, private offices. But none of them dealt with this type of situation, a facility that's open to the entire department. I'll call it a common area for lack of a better way to describe it. Both of those cases dealt with, and they both dealt not with a routine practice that was done for the purpose of managing the department. Both cases dealt with specific investigations of wrongdoing targeted at a particular individual. Both cases, on the other hand, both found that the actions of the government employer in that instance were reasonable and didn't violate the Fourth Amendment. So it's our position that there is no clearly established law that what the defendants did in this case was a violation of the Fourth Amendment. There are cases that suggest that it wasn't. The Jandak case didn't deal with the Fourth Amendment, but it dealt with Title III, and it found that this is a routine practice that's done in many departments, and it's not something that's generally unreasonable. It's actually been sanctioned by Congress in Title III. The Amati case, which I argued before this court almost 10 years ago, That was a case that went to a jury trial was found that a taping like this was a police department taping, not in the finance department, but it had all the other same characteristics and circumstances like this one, where this court found that it was appropriate under Title III. I think that a reasonable government official can look at those cases and say, okay, they didn't deal directly with the Fourth Amendment, but they did. Those cases were litigated. They were litigated fully through the federal courts. There did not emerge from those cases some conclusion that this was clearly established as a violation of the Fourth Amendment. So we believe that the district court erred on and denying qualified immunity, and I believe I have five rebuttals.
Actually, Mr. DeCiani, you used all your time. The white light is the indication that but I'll consider a minute in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Partolo.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. My name is John Partolo, and I represent Nick Narducci, the plaintiff and the class representative in this case. The district court properly denied summary judgment on qualified immunity on both the Fourth Amendment claims contained in Count 1 of the complaint and the Eavesdropping Act claims in Count 2. I'd like to treat each separately this morning. In considering Lem and Moore's claim for qualified immunity from the Fourth Amendment claim, the district court properly conducted the two-prong analysis required by Saucier versus Katz.
Let me ask you this.
Yes.
If no one listened to the tapes and the recordings have stopped, what's the real harm to the plaintiff?
The violation of both the Fourth Amendment.
I'm trying to figure out why he's suing.
Well,
practice is over. Was he injured just because his voice was recorded? Is that your?
Well, I would disagree that it's undisputed that no one listened to the tapes. That assertion has been made by the defendants, and my client disagrees with that. There is no evidence other than that after-the-fact testimony. Yeah, we had the tapes, and we didn't listen to them. There's been some.
Assertions indicate anyone did listen to them.
No, there's been some assertions that those tapes were not only not listened to, but they were destroyed or taped over after a relatively short period of time. That's incorrect. Former Chief Frisconi, who was the police chief of the village at the time the taping scheme was implemented, has testified, and there is a memo in the record that he prepared in 2002 after this litigation was already commenced, where he was tasked with the job of listening to the tapes during the period in question. He listened to those tapes and reviewed them and actually prepared a memo and advised the village of which tapes should be retained for evidentiary purposes. I believe that those tapes still exist.
Yeah, but the point is they weren't listened to at the time. They weren't listened to during the 30-day. You know, you don't have any evidence they were listened to at the time. That's a different thing to be having them listened to and evaluated once the litigation began.
Correct, but it's our position that neither the Fourth Amendment or the Eavesdropping Act require the actual listening to of the tapes. The violation of the Fourth Amendment is the seizure of the conversation, and that violation happens at the moment that the conversation is taped. Likewise, under the Eavesdropping Act, the violation of the Eavesdropping Act occurs at the moment of interception of the conversation. It doesn't require that any of the tapes are listened to. It doesn't. The violation doesn't isn't premised upon the state actor thereafter using or misusing the content of the conversation.
So, still, what harm is there to your client?
Well,
I mean, and what real harm can you show? Aren't we talking about nominal damages?
Well, I don't believe we are. I don't believe we are, but not only just to my client, but all of the other.
I mean the whole class. But
all of the other callers. I'll give you a good example. At some point, the various unions that negotiated contracts with the village of Bellwood on behalf of the various groups of employees that work for the village had on-site union negotiators negotiating a contract with the village. Mr. Narducci has testified that those actual union on-site negotiators, at the conclusion of each day of negotiations, used the taped phones to call back to their union superiors and discuss the state of the negotiations. The situations like that give cause or rise for real harm to the taping of the conversations.
But there's no evidence that that was used by anybody.
That's correct. And it's our position there doesn't have to be any evidence or any proof that the conversations are actually listened to. And I think the district and counsel referred to the Amati case, and they refer both to the Abbott and Amati case in their briefs and in the lower court. I think this is instructive. The district court in Amati, in discussing the plaintiff's wiretapping claims, observed, quote, whether the communication is heard by the human ear is irrelevant. As the Fifth Circuit noted in U.S. versus Turk, if a tree falls in the forest while no living listeners, with no living listeners, there's still a sound if an active tape recorder is present. The sound is orally acquired at the instant the action causing it occurred. If a wiretap is placed on an individual's phone and the conversation is recorded yet never listened to, the individual's conversations would be chilled if he knew of the wiretap. This would be so even if the individual was assured that no one would listen to his conversations, because the individual's privacy interests are no longer autonomous. Rather, his privacy interests are the subject to another's power, principally the power of the possessor of those tapes. And those tapes, even to this day, those tapes still exist. And the possessor of those tapes has the power over the privacy of those people whose conversations are recorded.
This de minimis issue that appellant now makes, did the district court judge have a chance to review that issue?
The issue of whether the tapes were actually listened to?
Yes.
He did. And as counsel referred to earlier, the Carey versus Pifus case, he did refer at the hearing after the decision on summary judgment was rendered. He talked about that and talked about that there may be the issue still remained whether the nominal damages would be appropriate or actual damages. He did.
Of course, at this point, you can't point to any cases from our circuit that address this whole issue of telephone or electronic recordings in the workplace that's similar to anywhere close to our situation.
Well, I think, and I've cited in my brief, both the Shields versus Burge and the Gossmeyer case refer to set the parameters of a workplace search. No, they do not specifically deal.
Those are really, really broad standards.
I would disagree. I believe the two-pronged test that was set forth in O'Connor was clarified and adopted by this court in both Shields and Gossmeyer. And this court principally said that the search, in this case the recording of the telephone lines in the finance department, had to be reasonable under all of the circumstances. And I think the district court dealt with that. It looked at all of the circumstances and the proffered reasons for instituting the taping and found that under all of the circumstances they were clearly unreasonable. And we would agree with that.
Now, what would have made it reasonable, Mr. Partlow? A more limited duration, notice? Do we need both notice and duration? Presumably, taping could have occurred under some circumstances that would be appropriate. You would agree with that?
Oh, I don't agree with that. I believe that there were other measures that could have been taken given the proffered reasons.
There could be other measures, but I'm asking you, could, with, let's say, appropriate notice and limited duration, is your position that any taping would be inappropriate?
No, and I think the district court found did not take that position either. I think we've raised a material issue of fact about whether the proffered reasons were in fact justifiable and legitimate reasons. I think we've raised numerous issues of fact, and I think the district court has acknowledged that in its opinion. The district court took one step farther and found.
So you would say any taping would never be subject to a qualified immunity defense because you would always have to have a trial on the policy.
No, and I wouldn't take that position.
I thought you were just saying that.
In answer to your earlier question, there's certainly an issue of fact as to the notice to the employees and other callers. Had there been an audible beep tone, for example, with the incoming callers, and that notified them, typically this arises typically outside of the police department routine taping of all phone lines, arises in cases of insurance carriers and others, and there's typically a recording that says, as you get on the phone, this call is recorded for quality assurance or for other purposes. And accompanied by a traditional beep tone would put the caller on notice that the conversation is being recorded and that any privacy interests that he may have in the conversation are being affected. So in this case, there I think the record is fairly clear about the beep tone. Chief Frasconi, who was the chief at the time the taping was instituted, was also tasked later, shortly before leaving the village, with reviewing the circumstances and specifically with coming up with the answer to the question, when did the taping stop? And he's testified, and he put forth a report that's in the record, that he didn't hear any audible beep tone on the tape, on any of the tapes that he listened to. He testified that it was his understanding at the time that the taping was instituted that an audible beep tone would be placed on the line, but his testimony was, in reviewing all of the tapes, he heard no audible beep tone. Mr. Narducci has likewise testified from the day he began work at the village that he heard no audible beep tone. The testimony, I think, or the evidence is undisputed, that there were no other notice to the employees of the finance department that the taping was had been instituted on those phones. So in answer to your question, no. I think under these circumstances, the district court properly found that the taping was unreasonable because of the lack of notice, as well as the lack of any other measures taken to implement the proffered reason for the taping. There was no notice to the employees who may have been, or to the callers who may have been irate and threatening the employees. And there was no follow-up. There were no police reports. There were no memos. There is not a single shred of paper in this entire case that reflects either of the two proffered reasons for instituting the taping on the finance department lines. And I think that's telling. And I think the district court found that was telling and found that under the totality of the circumstances that those proffered reasons weren't legitimate and the taping was unreasonable under those circumstances. Now, we believe the district court properly found, based on the evidence, that Mr. Narducci had a reasonable expectation of privacy on the calls made both to and from the finance department telephone lines. Both Mr. Narducci's actions before he discovered the taping and his actions thereafter when he discovered the scheme support that conclusion. Defendants Lem and Moore have offered no evidence that Narducci willingly exposed his conversations on the taped lines to others. Moreover, the evidence presented by Narducci showed that until February 28, 2000, neither he nor the other users of the taped lines had any notice that they were being taped. I think for further support of this proposition, this court should look at its opinion in Davis versus Zirkelbach, the Fifth Circuit's discussion in U.S. versus Turk, and the Eleventh Circuit's discussion in U.S. versus Nelson. Each of these cases discusses the unlawful interception of telephone conversations under the Eavesdropping Act, which I'll get to in a minute, and stands for the premise that the prohibited act, the interception of the conversation, occurs at the moment of recording. This reasoning, we believe, applies with equal force to the seizure of a conversation under the Fourth Amendment. We believe there also remains a legitimate question of fact whether this work-related workplace search was indeed workplace related. Under the two-prong test in O'Connor versus Ortega, the search, to be reasonable, must be justified at its inception, and it must be reasonably related in scope to the circumstances which prompted it. The court found that for the reasons proffered by the defendants for the taping, threats to an employee, complaints of poor customer service, or excessive personal calls by employees, may have justified the search at its inception. We believe we've raised legitimate material issues of fact as to whether that's true. However, the court acknowledged that Narducci had raised those material issues of fact, but leapt over that and came to the conclusion that even though the first test of the two-prong test may have been satisfied, i.e., there were legitimate reasons for instituting the taping scheme.
But if the village also just wanted to keep a record of phone calls for instances where some of their employees behaved unprofessionally with some of the callers, wouldn't that give them a legitimate reason to continue the recording even for the full 6 years?
Well, they didn't, and they didn't implement any measures that would suggest that was a legitimate reason for the taping. For example, an irate caller calls in and complains about the service, setting up a system where the finance department employees take down that caller's name, that caller's number, and refer it up the chain of command for an investigation. What were the complaints? How can we effectively deal with them? In the instance of these alleged threats to employees, even Comptroller Lagan, who is the the principal person who, after the fact, is providing these justifications for instituting the taping, even he testified that he could only think of one instance where an employee of the finance department was actually threatened. Mr. Lagan, and we think it important, too, that for the material issues of fact that we raised over the legitimacy of the reasons, the reasons for instituting this taping scheme come principally from the longtime comptroller of the Village of Bellwood, who was himself discovered stealing village funds and was forced out of his position. We believe that the district court took all of the circumstances into account as to the proffered justification for the taping. And the failure to institute any other measures and the failure to have even a shred of documentation over the taping and the reasons for it, we think are just simply make the taping unreasonable on its face. even under the and we acknowledge and we have in our brief that the there are less rigorous standards for a workplace search, but we think even in under these circumstances the district court properly found that the search was unreasonable.
Would you say no matter what the duration under the facts of this case, Mr. Partolo, that the lawlessness, if it be, is apparent on its face? That's the Supreme Court teaches us in Shields, right? That it's got to be apparent, the lawlessness.
Correct.
And so if they did this for a week, I'm just thinking beyond this case, under the same circumstances, but we had a duration issue, or we don't have a duration issue, would you say it was apparent? What makes this on its face? Is it the combination of scope and duration?
Correct. To respond to your question, even the taping for a week, if it had been combined with the additional measures that we've discussed that would add the legitimacy to the proffered reason for the taping, the irate employees threatening or irate customers threatening employees or the unacceptable employee behavior, yes, then it could be viewed as reasonable. But under these circumstances,
it clearly
is not.
Suppose you had an employee who you were reported engaged in misconduct and dialogue with customers, but perhaps the management didn't feel it had cause to fire or some union relationship would be impaired, whatever scenario, and so it doesn't disclose, but the duration is short. I'm just trying to frame up how one cabins this this principle here. Where we go with it? It seems to me that you can eliminate all attempts to monitor surreptitiously, that is, if we say there must be notice and the duration must be short.
Well, no,
which may be the case. I don't know.
I believe they must have notice at a minimum, Judge, and I think that would be consistent with the given reason for instituting the taping. If you're dealing with what you view as unacceptable employee behavior, whether that be a bad customer service or excessive use of the phones for personal calls, clearly simply instituting a taping program doesn't directly attempt to solve that problem. You tell the employees, hey, guess what? You're using the phones too often for personal calls. We're taping the calls and we're going to monitor them. Knock it off. In that case, those measures combined with the taping and a short duration, sure, could certainly be viewed reasonable under the less rigorous standards of a workplace search. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Partolo. Mr. DeCiani, your time had expired, but you may have an additional minute.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. I'll try to make it as useful as I can. It seems like the what plaintiff focused on the most is a litany of different measures that can be taken would make a taping, a routine taping, reasonable. They may all be very good ideas, but the point is there's never been clearly established as to what makes something reasonable. Routine taping of government lines has been sanctioned. We know from Jandek, we know from Amati, we know from a number of other cases. It is not per se illegal. You mentioned
what were the limits here, Mr. DeCiani?
The limits are not clearly established. And counsel talked about notice as though notice is the talisman. But if I can quote from Amati, the plaintiffs argue that wiretapping cannot be in the ordinary course of law enforcement unless there is express notice to the people whose conversations are being listened to. The statute does not say this, and it cannot be right. That was this court in Amati. There hasn't been a case that says you have to have notice. There isn't a case that says that you have to. It has to be limited in duration. Nothing like the First Amendment, most narrow measure, has ever been adopted in this instance. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.